I'm here today with Patrick Ashworth, who is the former British High Commissioner to Belize, and he was in post from 2008 until 2013. So, Patrick, thank you for agreeing to this interview today. I wondered if we could start by you telling us about your career, basically. I know that you've had a long and very interesting career in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and that it would be very interesting to learn more about that.
Sure, a long and completely undistinguished career in the Foreign Office. Well, I'm a Cumbrian by birth, and I joined the Foreign Office in 1968, and I had quite a few postings. I started off in Tanzania, where I met my wife. It's our golden wedding next year, actually. And then I went to St. Lucia, spent some time in the old Soviet Union, went on to Malta, to Brazil, where I've been twice, and to the Netherlands, and then ending up in Belize in 2008.
And what capacity did you work in all of these different places?
I've done everything. I was involved in trade, press and public affairs, and of course, finally, these days, unless you're at a major mission, you just muck in and do just about everything.
So what took you to Belize?
I'd come to the end of a tour in the UK, and there was, I think, a call sent out for somebody who could go out to Belize quite quickly, as they needed someone speedily. I threw my hat into the ring and just more or less got the job. And then, after that 6 months temporary posting, my man there had to bid formally for the post and got it then.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Belize, its history, its culture?
Yeah, it's a peculiar place, probably completely different to the islands of the Caribbean. And that's the first thing, of course, is it's not an island. It shares that with Guyana. Guyana on the mainland of South America and Belize on the mainland of Central America. And it's sort of pinched between Mexico to the north, Guatemala to the east. And that is where the history begins with Guatemala. It's a very peculiar story about Belize, but the first British people that went there way back in the 1600s, pirates, buccaneers, call them what you will, went there because they discovered that there was logwood there. Now, logwood, for those who don't know, is a bush, a tree, from which you can make black dye. And in those days, a bit like today, black was the colour to be in. And so the British began to take the logwood from there. And Brazil has a long tradition in forestry, which we'll possibly get onto later.
Belize.
A long tradition of forestry. And
I think that many Belizeans after World War II, they went and worked in Scotland, is that right?
They did, the woodcutters. They went there towards the end of World War II and went there to do forestry. And in fact, books have been written about them, learned articles have been written about them as well. Again, very, very few people from Belize, though, ever came to the UK. I mean, the whole thing about Belize is the strange thing. It was part of Spain, if you like, part of Spanish Central America, and it was. It's the only Caribbean territory claimed by another state. To this day, Guatemala, in its constitution, has a claim on most of the territory of Brazil, if not all of the territory.
Belize.
That's what happens when you go visiting other countries. So Belize, yeah, it's the only former colony whose territory is claimed by another state. Guatemala claims that it was always part of the Captaincy General of Guatemala. And so when all the Central American states cast off the yoke of Spanish colonialism, that became part of Guatemala. The argument from the Belizean side which I think is the correct one, that actually it was part of the captaincy of Yucatan. So it was different from the rest of Central America. And so the British carried on with their logwood, and more and more people went there. The Treaty of Paris, ending the Seven Years' War in 1763, for the historians, recognised the right of the English settlers to cut the logwood there. And in 1862, Britain declared it a crown colony, which was then subordinate to Jamaica, and that was when it became known as British Honduras. The people are completely different as well to other parts of the Caribbean. Many of them are still what they call Creoles, or Afro-Caribbean, as we'll call them, something around about 21% now. The Mayans, who, of course, were there in and around that area from ancient times, and there's now three types of them there. You've got the Quechi, who came from Guatemala, the Mopan, who were the indigenous Mayans, and the Yucatec, who came from Mexico. And then you have people called mestizos, which are mixed Spanish and Mayans, a distinct grouping of themselves. And then you have the Garifuna, or the Garinagu, who were, it's another of those strange stories as well, but they were sort of West African, Arawak and Caribs, a mixture. And they made the great mistake of supporting the French in the Anglo-French Wars in the Caribbean. So then the British rounded up all the most African-looking ones, more or less put them on a ship and sent them off where they landed at Roatan, which is a small island off Honduras. That was far too small for them.
So principally, what were the British interests in Belize?
Well, it was mainly logwood. That was how it started. And that kept on until, because there were very few people there, and then later on, of course, it became sugar, a story familiar to many in the Caribbean, that kind of thing as well.
And Belize gained independence from Britain in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me about migration around that time? Where were Belizeans travelling to? Where were they looking to settle? What's the story of migration in and around Belize?
Yeah, it's strange because there's never been a great migratory pattern from Belize to the UK. The traditional pattern of migration was north to the United States, mainly because it was so easy. In 2 days, you can catch a bus from the border with Mexico, get on a bus there, travel 2 days through Mexico and end up on the border with the United States. A lot of people took advantage of that, and they've been going there since late 50s, early 60s. I was speaking by messenger indeed to a friend of mine just the other day, and I was asking him about this, and he just said, "Oh, my grandmother is 95, and she went to the United States in the 60s. And I said, "Well, how did she get?" I said, "Literally just got on a bus and went there." And it was very easy to get through the border in those days. There weren't the border controls that there are now. And so that was the real reason. It was just so easy. There was never any direct connections between Belize and the UK. Even today, there are no direct air routes, no direct sea routes either.
And also the economy, the Belizean economy then depends heavily on its relationship with the United States.
It does. Well, most of the tourists come from there. But, of course, there's most people reckon there's about 160,000 Belizeans in the United States.
And how big is the population of Belize?
Now it's about 400,000.
Right.
In the 60s, when this began, it was a quarter of that, so it was around about 100,000. But it relies, to a certain extent, on remittances from those Belizean Americans. I mean, I didn't know till I got there that athletes like Marion Jones was actually a Belizean as well, and Simone Biles, the gymnast, as well. So there's a, you know, they've got this great history in the United States, and to this day we think there's only about 3,000 Belizeans in the UK.
Yeah, tiny. We're talking really small numbers.
Very small numbers.
So that brings me to your role then as British High Commissioner. What do you remember from that time? I know that you began in 2008. What were kind of the main priorities in your role? What areas of work were you concentrating on? What conversations were you having?
Yeah, I can give you the formal answer, of course, that, you know, like all High Commissioners, we're there to maintain relations. But, you know, Belize is part of the Commonwealth. It was the only English-speaking country in Central America, so it was a great platform for the UK there. We'd had British Armed Forces in Belize for a long, long time. They were there originally to help British Honduras, Belize, against the Guatemalan threat. Now it's a training unit called BATSO, British Army Training Support Unit Belize.
And as we know, Central America was obviously, for the US, particularly during the Reagan period, was a very fraught and hostile time.
Yeah, this is where Belize's population really exploded. Because it took in refugees from Central America, from El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala. The Guatemalan, repression, I guess, was particularly awful, and particularly awful against indigenous people like the Mayans, so that's why there are so many. But the Mayans, for example, don't recognise any of the borders. You know, they've always crossed down that road, over that river. They don't see it like that. So Belize took a lot of what we'd call now refugees, I guess just people, and gave them a place to live. You know, they didn't have refugee camps or anything.
What do you know about registrations, particularly in the 1980s? Do you know whether people held any form of documentation?
That's a good question. I know that they registered them all because the UN set up an office for refugees in Belize at that time, so they would have...
records.
Yes, they would have records there. Most of the people are now Belizean. They're proud to be Belizean. But for that reason, Belize now, they speak as much Spanish or more Spanish than English. The lingua franca of everybody is Creole. Fascinating.
So, coming on to the Windrush scandal, then, during your role as High Commissioner, did you have any inkling or any idea of potential issues around questions of registration and access to citizenship and other matters concerning Caribbean-descended people or people from the Caribbean living in the UK? Did you hear anything through the High Commission?
No, I mean, everybody knew about Windrush, about Windrush arriving, the Windrush generation. I mean, that's just part of history now. But at that time, we didn't realise that there were going to be these particular problems. And also Belize, I guess if it was in the UK press, we would have seen it. But Belize didn't get the BBC TV, for example. BBC World, I think they call it now. It didn't get that. The World Service, of course, had downgraded its Caribbean service. And so really, places like Belize really didn't get all that much British news until the internet came. Then people could choose to download in news. But it never came up while I was there. I was speaking to the present High Commissioner just to ask her. She said nobody on the official side has raised.
And what's her name?
Claire. Oh, gosh. I'm having a senior.
Don't
worry. I'll give you the name later. Nobody has raised it. I spoke to the FCO historian who deals with Belize, and he said no.
It just
never came up at all.
How about what was happening at the High Commission? So Belizeans who were either planning a trip to the UK or needed a visa. How were you dealing with those processes, and what was your role?
Well, trips to the UK, no problem. You just turn up, like with many countries, you know, and you get assessed at the at the border.
So visa-free entry.
Visa-free entry. If people needed to go to study or to work, then they'd need a visa. And that included Chevening scholars at the time and everything like that. Towards the end, they'd introduced the new system. And so you had to give biometrics and all the rest of it. But the problem was that they didn't set up visa handling stations in every country. So if you're a Belizean, even, say, a Chevening scholar whose bona fides couldn't be called into question, you would either have to go to Miami on the way out, hoping you're going to pick up your visa, give you biometrics, wait a couple of days, and then pick up a visa, or go to Panama at that time to give you biometrics. Literally take a trip to Panama, give you fingerprints, take your picture, take and come back.
So there was no service available then to people to be able to apply to...
To legally
enter the UK.
Yeah, this was towards the end. You literally had to go and give your electronic...
Was it always that way?
No, before, most countries used to have visa vignettes that they could be issued and stuck into your passport.
Right, so that was closed down then?
Yeah, they closed it all in most of the kind of, like St. Lucia, for example, wouldn't have one. St. Vincent wouldn't, St. Kitts. Some of the bigger ones, Jamaica, would have a visa issuing office.
Yeah, and in fact, you mentioned that you spent some time in St. Lucia. Did you, what capacity were you working there as?
I don't know what my title was now when I was there. I think management officer or something.
Was that at the High Commission?
It was then, because at that time, St. Lucia was what they called the West Indies Associated States. So rather like Belize became in 1964, it was internally self-governing. But the Foreign Affairs and Defence was carried out by the UK. We used to issue passports, we used to issue visas, and it was all done by personal interview. Passports were issued by hand, but as everything becomes more mechanised, it was mechanised first, now it's digitalised.
Yeah, and what year was that you were there?
I was in St. Lucia from 75 to 78.
Yeah, so very different, and this is what we're hearing as well with the High Commissioners that we're speaking to. A very different form of interaction took place before the digitisation, really, of visa processing services. Do you think, in your experience, in the comparison between St. Lucia and your experience in Belize, do you think that has... is it a positive thing? Do you think it's taken away anything from that service? Were you hearing any complaints or any comments from people about frustrations or issues they were having?
We certainly did, because it's taken any flexibility out of the system. If you come to me as a St. Lucian, and to be fair, we used to have a roving visa issuing officer. We'd take the documents in and process them, and then the roving visa officer would come around every month and
In St. Lucia,
yeah. So what would happen if, for example, I'll give you a real example, was that we were sending a Chevening scholar to the UK, and they were going to take their family, she was going to take her husband, family, and they were going to take a nanny as well. So they had a bob or two. And so she put all her documents in, but there was some problem with her documents from the University of Belize. Transcript wasn't quite right, or it was the wrong period or something like that. She got up to Miami, and the whole visa was refused. So a Chevening scholar, good bona fides, from a family, loads of loot, I mean, you know. And it was turned down, whereas if she'd come to see us, we could have said, look, can you go and...
So that happened back when you were in Belize?
Yeah.
Is that correct? So what did she do to try and rectify that situation?
She had to come back and do it again. And to add insult to injury, her nanny got given the visa. And so that happened all the time. So it's taken flexibility out of the system. I'm sure it's more efficient, more cost effective.
But what was the reaction of this woman, though? Was she angered by this? Was she frustrated by it?
Both. But she kept her eye on the main thing, which was get to the UK to do her course, to do her master's. And these things, but they do leave a bit of a nasty taste. And it's this you know, if you talk about soft power, being turned down for a visa on a minor, I would say a minor administrative ground, isn't really showing soft power. And so that's what I say, there's no flexibility in the system. If there's no personal interaction, you can't tell them to go away and come back in 10 minutes with a different document.
And where did they go in Miami? Was it the British Embassy?
They give the biometrics, I think, at various Homeland Security places now.
Right.
I think that we've got an arrangement where you can do that. Don't forget, this is a couple of years back, so
yeah,
things
might
have changed since
yeah.
then. And yeah, and then they would go and get their visa from the consulate.
Mm. It's a very interesting that you talk about soft power as well, because did you, thinking in terms of kind of diplomatic relations and maybe the image that Britain was projecting of itself overseas, do you think that that has caused any kind of ill feeling or damage to the British reputation in the sense that people are, you know, being blocked basically essentially from either acquiring certain visas or getting the documentation they need?
Yes, no, I think it obviously does, and it's incremental. One you can put down to just a minor administrative glitch. If it's two or three, people begin to smell a rat. And
would people be told the reasons why their documentation was refused?
Yes, they would say there's a problem there. But unfortunately, there's a problem there. We'll hold your documents, give us another one. It's refused. And then you've got to pay the visa fee again and those kind of things.
So thinking back to, sorry to jump
right.
again, but thinking back to St. Lucia, because I think it's really fascinating that you had... that you had this experience, this kind of comparative experience, right, of the personal interactions that people would have with the High Commission. Is there anything else that you remember from that time that you think's changed over the past few decades?
Well, the obvious one is we're much smaller now than we were then. I mean, I think when I got there was actually 7 UK-based staff there.
In St. Lucia,
you know, it was an information officer. It wasn't a High Commission, it was a British government representative, and then
yeah.
a deputy British government representative,
yeah.
and we had all sorts of a big team. And now I think there's one person there in these small islands. So things have changed.
And we know that St. Lucians have been... quite heavily affected by, for being such a small place, it has been affected by the Windrush scandal quite significantly. Can you think of any reasons as to why that might be?
Why they're affected? I guess it's just the sheer numbers. There was always a long tradition of connections between St. Lucia and the UK. Direct flights is one thing. The Geest banana boats being another one.
Mm.
They used to send at least every week, if not more, boats out to collect the bananas. Some of the crew were St. Lucian. So there was a bit of a pattern of St. Lucian migration to the UK, which is totally unlike Belize. So I can see why that would affect some of these small islands as well.
So Belize, in a sense, is an outlier. In the sense that its migration has been principally towards the
mm-hmm.
US. There are Belizeans present in the UK, but the numbers are very, very small. And also, really, the Windrush scandal didn't resonate, if at all, with most Belizeans. What was, from your... I know that this is after your time because you finished your post in 2013, but when the scandal broke, what were your... where were you? Were you in the UK? What were your memories of what was happening? And also, what did your Belizean colleagues think about this? Have you spoken to them about...
I can answer that one, that it's really gone completely over their heads. They're not involved. I think if at a political level, of course, the Belizean government will go along to CARICOM meetings where these will be raised, and I'm sure they'll fall into line with the other Caribbean countries. And I think all this builds into this idea that they have to get rid of, if you like, any last vestiges of colonialism,
mm-hmm.
because they get nothing from it,
mm-hmm.
and that all the time, you know, there are obstacles put in their way, and so the idea that we can always rely on them, for example, to vote with our judge in the on a court, you know, on an international court and those kind of things. I think those days have gone, and this doesn't help.
So where do you see the future going in terms of UK-Belizean relations? What do you think the strategy is? I know that the recent visit of the royals to to the country was met with a number of protests, and there was quite a lot that came out in the press about people's reaction to that. Well, do you think there is a future for?
Well, I'm proud to say that he says, smiling, that when I was there, Harry came out, and it was a great success. I mean, much more of a success than we could possibly have thought, you know, cheering crowds all the way, that kind of thing.
So tell me about that trip. How did that come to be? What was...
It was part of the... I'm trying to think. It couldn't have been the Jubilee, but it was... I think, was it the accession of the Queen to the throne or something? It was some Jubilee. And like this one, everybody went... The royal family sent people out to all of the realms where the Queen was still the head of state, and Harry was chosen to come here, and he went to Jamaica, and I think to Bermuda, I think he went, and he was the proverbial rock star. He was met with cheers and everything. It was brilliant. And then, of course, we had this one where. I think there was one major protest, wasn't there, down in the south with the I think they were Mayans as well, and so they changed the itinerary. I think it was still a success though, and often it's. But the feeling that you have in other parts of the Caribbean are because of our history. Now the history is not exactly how should we put it without its. Without its problems in the Caribbean. But most people would recognise Britain. In Belize, the Afro-Caribbeans are only something like 20% of the population, still the biggest group, I think, just about. But the Mestizos, the Garifunas, they probably have a long history with the UK, but the just normal, everyday Latinos that have emigrated, they have no connection with the UK at all. So most people there don't feel this connection, have never had it, and so.
But that, interestingly, is I've been getting similar responses. For example, speaking to people in Jamaica and in other parts of the Caribbean, that Britain really is being left behind in the sense that people feel more culturally, they have more. They feel more culturally aligned with the US. There's increased migration there, that people are watching TV shows. In that sense, I think it's quite interesting if we think about the Windrush scandal, because it didn't really, or from what I'm hearing, is that it didn't really resonate with people who were in the Caribbean. It wasn't seen. It was seen as something that was a British thing, and
British
something that
scandal.
Was far away. So it didn't really feed into any kind of organised activism or protest.
I can see that, because the numbers are still small. If you say Jamaica, I mean, I don't know how many have been returned, deported, call it what you will, a few hundred, I would guess. Jamaica's got a huge population. So you can imagine it being very important for anybody connected with that. I mean, I would feel outraged if it happened to me. But in the great scheme of things, Jamaica has a lot of problems, and a couple of hundred people probably is not, for them, is not that much of an issue. It is a British issue, and it's for us to resolve. And it has to be done with some sensitivity, which I don't get the impression it is being done with any sensitivity at all. I'm not even sure it's really being addressed properly. That's what I think.
So the conversations you had as High Commissioner then, for example, when you went to activities organised by CARICOM or CHOGM or any kind of regional organised events, what were the main themes that were coming up at the time? What was on the agenda? What were people raising as being the most important items that they wanted to address?
Belize very rarely hosted events like that. It didn't have the infrastructure. It is doing so now.
Can I ask how many people were working at the High Commission at the time?
About half of them, I would think. Oh, sorry, that's an old joke. There were, I think, from the UK, two of us.
Two, so tiny.
It was tiny.
A High Commissioner and a...
Deputy High Commissioner.
And that was it. Okay.
There was another one who was a sort of general factotum, but that post was cut, and all the posts we used to have were all... mainly done by locally engaged staff. Good locally engaged staff.
Did you have an office in the capital, or
yeah.
did you share an office?
No,
with
we have our
premises?
Own building in Belmopan, and not very far from the government offices. There's a little enclave, diplomatic enclave there where the offices are. We were right next to the Mexicans and that kind of thing. And the government offices were, well, I could walk to them. Of course, I never did, but I could.
So, I'm sorry, I jumped a little, but I was asking about the items on the agenda of for example, CARICOM meetings in and around 2008. What were some of the things that you were talking about with your contemporaries or that you were trying to, issues you were trying to address with
other
commissioners?
CARICOM isn't obsessed with the UK, that's the thing. They have a region to look after. And especially if it becomes CARIFORUM, where it was the more economic side of it, where they'd have Haiti and states like that in as well. One of the things that did crop up while I was there was reparations. But again, that wasn't a big thing this was mainly, I think, Guyana, Trinidad and Jamaica really pushed that one. But it's still there. They have a reparations commission, and I think that one won't go away. But Belize is almost schizophrenic because half of it is looking towards the Caribbean and the other half is looking towards Central America. And so it was a member of the Central American organization as well, and I think it sees that's where a lot of its trade is going to go in future. The other community I've not mentioned in Belize is a very large community of Mennonites, and they're big farmers. And they were exporting a lot of beans and other produce, cattle, to Guatemala and other Central American countries. And they had signed partial scope agreements with the Central American Federation as well. So Belize probably didn't even think as much about CARICOM as it did about the Central Americans.
In that sense, it played... It stood in an interesting position, right? Well, it stands in an interesting position to be, have one foot basically in kind of what the Caribbean is and one foot in Central America, which I think is fascinating in terms of diplomacy and trade and the decisions that...
It is. I think George Price, who was the first, he was a great sort of leader of independence and the first prime minister, definitely saw the future as being Central American rather than Caribbean. He's probably right as well. And the trade flows from the Caribbean weren't that great. The trade flows mainly are from Central America and from North America. So, for example, if you want your Marmite, it usually comes with an American label on because it's come from the UK to the United States and down in containers from the United States to the shops in Belize.
And you mentioned earlier that remittances are... hugely important as well. Where do they come from mainly?
From the US.
Which I know you were saying that people cross on the Mexican border. Are there parts, specific parts of the US where there's a high number of higher number of Belizeans that have settled?
The ones I know about: New York, Boston, oddly, California. They spread out all over, so I think Los Angeles as well is quite a lot. But they actually have, they have Belize Days and all sorts in these places, which you don't see in... It's almost like they have their own carnival,
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned to me earlier that you have... that you also have a background in immigration, that you used to work in... Was it in the immigration service? Or was
no, I was always in the Foreign Office, but at that time, we were immigration officers. The the FCO used to do most of the immigration work. I mean, not all of it. There was always Home Office, but a lot more immigration work was done by Foreign Office. So I did my immigration officer training. I went out as a...
Yeah, so tell me about the day-to-day then, the ins and outs of your job, what was expected at that time and the kind of decisions that you were faced with.
Well, the most that I ever did at any one time was in Malta, oddly, rather than the Caribbean. And you just set half a day aside for interviewing people and the other half for writing up interview notes. Nothing was taped, everything was written by hand. Precede by hand.
Are we talking about the 1970s, is this?
Or? This would be the 80s.
The 80s. Yeah. And what kind of decisions then were you expected to make? What were people applying for?
Everything from family visas, work visas, absolutely everything you can think of. We did just about everything.
Mm.
Family reunification, marriage visas, always very difficult because we used to, when the British office in Libya closed after the murder of W.P.C. Fletcher, all the Libyans came to Malta.
Yeah.
So suddenly my job changed considerably. And there were a lot of Indian labourers in Libya, so we began to get Commonwealth immigration. Well, Malta, of course, was like that itself. So we got Indian immigration as well, became quite a busy little immigration place.
Yeah, and of course, as you know, people affected by the, as it's called, the Windrush scandal were not solely from the Caribbean. They were from Southeast Asia and from other parts of the former, other parts of the Commonwealth,
yeah.
The former Commonwealth. So did you pick up on any issues around or any issues around passports or around birth certification?
No, I couldn't say there were any. I think the only oddities we used to get was because of Libya's situation, we'd have people coming in with old Palestinian passports from when they'd been in the British forces in Palestine just after the war, those kind of things.
And what was the attitude towards, for example, out-of-date documents or if people didn't have the right paperwork? Would you say that it was more relaxed or that the systems were different in those days? What do you think has been changing, basically, since the 1980s?
Well, you make fewer decisions yourself, I think.
And who makes those decisions?
Well, decisions are now taken by immigration officers at central processing hubs. And...
So they're faceless then?
They're faceless. But we could, of course, ring up the visa office in the United States and explain why we thought this person should get it. And occasionally they used to say, yeah, perhaps we should have issued. And so we had a record.
So you had direct contact, basically, with immigration decision makers. And you had sometimes the ability to influence.
You could ask for an administrative review. I think if you were the... a High Commission ringing up saying, we really think this person is genuine, could you do an administrative review? And the Chief Immigration Officer would often have a look. Sometimes they would reverse the decision of the Immigration Officer. A lot of it, of course, is outsourced now as well, so you're not necessarily dealing with... Home Office Immigration people.
Who would you be dealing with?
I don't know who the latest company is.
So basically decisions on British immigration are not actually being made by British officials, essentially. It can be outsourced to...
I think they're all checked, I think, by British Home Office officials. But the collection is, of course, collection of data, collection of everything is all done by companies.
Yeah, and where is that? Where was paperwork being stored in those days?
In the old days, you'd keep it all. It was all stored
piled high in big.
No, it was all very well kept. That was the great thing about the Foreign Office in those days. Everything was in folders and dated, and then it would be returned to the UK, and it would be kept in the Foreign Office archives, which I think is up in Hounslow Park now, and would be reviewed. Mm. As well, so There was a system for recording and keeping archives.
So given your experience of these practices and this how records were archived and how the immigration process worked, it's kind of asking you to think maybe a bit beyond your own career, but can you think about or imagine maybe some of the problems that people who were affected by the Windrush scandal might have encountered, or some of the reasons why people were finding that they were being accused of being in the country, I don't like the term, but illegally. How do you think that came to be? And I'm particularly interested because I think the 1980s was such an important period in terms of changes to British nationality, mm-hmm. And how people were being basically, if you're born in the UK, you were no longer automatically entitled to British citizenship. So,
That was the British Nationality Act 1981.
It was,
which came in 1983, changed everything from if you're born in the UK, you're British, to if you're born in the UK and your parents are settled. That was the gist of it.
Did that affect your day-to-day work at all? Or did you see...
Well, we certainly had to do a lot of revision and mm-hmm. And everything. But
telling people's children, for example, that they weren't British, would you...
No, that would never happen. I mean, it would... Because the problem seems to have been that the children of the people that came didn't know they weren't. All they can remember is being in Britain all the time. They were in their parents' passport. As you probably remember, in the old days, you just used to add the child's name, no mm-hmm. picture or anything. So they came to the UK, grew up in the UK, went to school in the UK, got a job in the UK, National Insurance, Health Service. And then, either something happened, they had to do a check on nationality, and the Home Office or whoever decided they weren't British. And if there was a crime involved, they would be considered for the new automatic deportation if you got a prison sentence of more than 12 months. Mm. It was an unfortunate series of events.
But how bureaucratically do you think... I'm thinking more about the kind of problems that people can stumble into in terms of their documents. So either people didn't have... They either didn't own a passport, or they didn't renew a passport, or it was in their interaction with the British state that then they, as you said, they stumble upon this or realise that or are told that they're not seen as British. So I'm just thinking in terms of the kind of documentation issues and problems that you might have seen in your job.
I can't say I saw any, but of course, don't forget that Commonwealth citizens, Jamaicans, were citizens of the United Kingdom colonies. They had the same passport as you and I. And it was only when things changed, a lot of them never bothered to take out British nationality. They thought they were British all the time. Mm-hmm. And so when eventually the children came to do it, they didn't know they weren't. Everybody just assumed that they were all British. And by which time much of the documentation would have been automatically destroyed. And that's before we get into
destroyed in what way? Were they sent to a... was the decision made, for example, to destroy...
You can't just keep... There are rules about keeping records. I don't know what it is at the moment. You've probably heard of the 30-year rule for some records.
Yeah.
But records are reviewed regularly. So everything is filed, and then... Even if you just forget that it's about passports and immigration, every year you would look and see what you'd need to keep. Every 5 years you would look and see if those that you kept needed to be reviewed again. And then about every so often you would send what was left back to London for safekeeping.
So there will have been people caught up in the scandal who... There did exist records of... various aspects of them living in the UK, but those records and they could no longer access because they were either destroyed.
Yeah, records are automatically destroyed after a certain, after they're examined. I think that the problem was, as I understand it, was of course, as they were British, they didn't need anything, they just got on a boat. They didn't need entry clearance, they didn't need a visa, so there's no record of that in Jamaica, say. They landed here. Of course, they had their landing cards, which, as we know, that's an issue in itself, because they seem to have disappeared all over.
Yeah, Amelia Gentleman talks about that in her book, although I know there's some controversy over whether or not that was as major as an issue that it was talked about, but yeah, you're right.
But the point being that a British person at that time
you wouldn't expect
came to
Britain.
It was a bit like freedom of movement in the EU. You just went to France and decided to live, and then you'd register, just as those people would register at the town hall for a vote, they'd register with the NHS.
So what do you think has been one of the biggest failings of the British government in terms of basically allowing this problem to manifest?
I think it's a lack of flexibility and a lack of, I wouldn't like to say humanity, but look upon it as an administrative exercise rather than dealing with human lives. And that was the one thing I always used to tell people right from that beginning. You're dealing with real people. You're not just dealing with a piece of paper. This can affect somebody's life. So we always took great care when making a decision about a visa or anything like that, or was that person eligible for a passport.
But of course, when you made those decisions, or you and your team made those decisions, you saw people face to face. So you would see somebody who would come with maybe their partner and their children, and you would see a family, right? Whereas now the process is very much, you know, done behind a computer screen.
Yes.
So there's none of that actual engagement with a human being, right? You're not able to look in someone's eyes. You're not able to have that kind of personal connection with them.
It's very much computer says no, or computer says yes.
Yeah.
Shall we say? And if you just think of police work, skilled interrogators can get to the truth, and ECO, entry clearance officers, used to be quite skilled, not exactly interrogators, but skilled at reading the person.
Well, did you get that in your training as well, in your immigration training back in the day?
I'm not sure we did. I think it came from experience. The training was pretty good, but I don't think we did get that. Just through experience, there's something wrong here, let me press further. And often there was no issue. Don't forget, people are very nervous. People lie to you for good reasons. I think he wants to know this, not that you're not genuine, and this is the problem. And now, if there's any discrepancy, you can't press further. That's just the end of the process.
And it could be, as in the situation you described about this, clearly well-off woman who had submitted paperwork that wasn't accepted. So it could be a small clerical error. It could be something that is to do, maybe a date is with the wrong date, or the wrong, a bank account that doesn't show the right amount. These kind of decisions.
Yeah, something like a transcript from university didn't exactly accord with our annual...
Or a misspelled name, right?
Something along
official, there's a lot of discrepancies between official documentation and then, for example, a birth certificate and a passport might not have the same name. That's not the fault of the individual whatsoever, but it's something that then has an impact, can have an impact down the line. I find that very interesting, the idea around this kind of move towards, move from paper systems to kind of digital systems, but also that lack of human interaction and that lack of personal kind of, that lack of rapport, basically. And so what impact do you think that is having? I have asked this question earlier, but maybe now's a good time to come back to it, on British diplomatic relations then, on how people see the UK, what kind of impressions they get of how we treat immigrants and how we treat even our own citizens.
There were always refusals before. We mustn't underestimate this. So it's not very nice refusing people visas, but you have to do it sometimes if they simply don't.
What were some of the grounds you refuse people on?
The grounds for refusal are usually quite flimsy in themselves. It was always a double negative. I am not satisfied that you do not intend to leave. It would be. I mean, I've actually helped people while I was in the UK to appeal against visa refusals, and funnily enough, the person was Jamaican. One of the grounds was this person has this person's family has a history of emigration to the UK, so they suggested. There is hardly a Jamaican family that doesn't have a history of immigration to the UK. So to use that as a reason, I just pointed out he just didn't feel it was right and was throwing the kitchen sink in. Mm. And we got that one, referred to as a friend of my brother's, as it happened. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it sounds terrible, really, when you have to try to tell people it's got nothing to do with us if you're a diplomatic mission and you're getting a whole series of people. And this was a Chevening scholar, don't forget. But there are others who just come in crying their eyes out, I've been refused. Why? They don't say. And all you get is this rather strange reason.
And that doesn't happen anymore, right? Because now people are turned away, essentially.
Yeah, essentially they're just told they've been refused. And
to let
they will get a letter saying
there's basically no way of challenging that.
You can always appeal, but the grounds of appeal are always being narrowed down. I don't think you can appeal a visit visa, for example, and an appeal does take a long time. Mm. People would be better off trying again to apply the whole thing again.
Okay. Well, I think that's a really interesting discussion I think we've had today. I've really enjoyed learning about not only your time as High Commissioner, British High Commissioner to Belize, but also your role in St. Lucia, in Malta and in other contexts. And I think the immigration picture as well is something that's really fascinating because of the ins and outs, basically, of what you were doing. But you always worked in immigration for the Foreign Office, you said.
Yes.
Did you have any dealings with the Home Office?
Yes, we did, because it was kind of half and half. It was a joint Home Office, Foreign Office.
So. What was the relationship like with the Home Office? Sorry.
We always thought that the Home Office Immigration Service people were far too harsh. And I could tell you some stories, but I don't know them firsthand, but some not very nice people being sent out, determined to go through 3 years without issuing a visa, that kind of thing. But these are apocryphal. And so there was an element of that. The Home Office used to go to places like India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, where they had major immigration centres. The Foreign Office would do them in the smaller places.
So, and I'm also asking this question for the benefit of our listeners, but what is the difference then, administratively, between the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, as it was back then, CDO, and the Home Office? What different functions do they occupy?
They are completely different organisations. The Foreign Office staffs embassies, high commissions abroad. Where there are major immigration centres, you will find that a lot of the staff are then Home Office officials from the old immigration service, as well as Border Force, I guess, as it now is. And they do most of the visa work there. And it used to be half and half. Now it's very much, most of it is done by Home Office staff who are sent abroad, attached to a high commission or an embassy, not part of the Foreign Office, although they are diplomats for the purpose of issuing or not issuing visas.
And how does upper management in the Home Office view the... how did they view FCO staff and vice versa?
Well, I assume that just as we thought the Home Office staff were a bit too harsh, they thought the Foreign Office were a bunch of people all prepared to do anything for good relations with the host government. But none of us, I don't know anybody that would deliberately issue a visa to somebody that didn't deserve it. Mm. I think it was where you drew the line of deserving. I mean, they were professionals in the Home Office. They knew their stuff backwards, as did we. And they used to have to take some difficult decisions on family reunifications and those kind of things. Mm. That was an underlying tension, but everybody used to get on.
And you mentioned earlier you were talking about soft power. Do you think now the changes to the ways in which we're processing visas and dealing with people's requests, do you think that's affected British diplomacy in any way? Do you think that... Yeah, there's been a shift. I say this because in an earlier interview with another High Commissioner, with Arthur Snell, he was quite adamant that that this has taken away a lot of the kind of, not just the diplomatic rapport that High Commissioners have had in the past, but it's also taken power away in terms of Britain's standing overseas, because if anybody has an issue with a visa, if anybody needs to get a question answered, or if they need they're seeking some kind of guidance, they're turned away.
No, I think it's impossible to say anything else. It's out of your control. If I'm sitting in Belmopan or wherever and there's a visa problem, I can do nothing about it. They can come and ask me, and I can then relay that if the Prime Minister was to ring me up and say, issue my son a visa, not that it's likely to happen. In the old days, you'd have told him you'd look into it. Now, you've got a choice. Do you say, oh, it's nothing to do with us, Prime Minister? Or do you try and get in touch with your colleagues in Miami or Panama or wherever issuing? But if the answer's no, it's down to you. You know, that will sour relations. I think in the old days you could explain things to them a lot better. So making it more rigidly IT-based, has taken away a lot of this. These are intangible. Soft power, in essence, is intangible. And I'm not sure that intangible works anymore for the government. They want to see results now. Mm.
And statistics as well.
And statistics.
Numbers.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time today. Is there anything else that you'd like to say as part of this interview?
No, not really. It's just a fascinating subject, the Windrush, worrying at the same time. And I hope it can get cleared up, because there are some real people that have been hurt by this, and it's not their own fault.
Okay, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.